Dad, what's going on?
Hey, Pete, we're finally in the same house.
I know. The good times are going to roll.
Oh, yeah.
So, I've invited Dad on here for this series, Pete's Two Cents. I asked you guys on Instagram what to call it, and the best suggestion I had, I think, was Pete's Two Cents. So,
does that make this worth 4 cents?
That's it. Yeah. So, this is Pete and Dad's 4 cents. Before we get started, I'm opening up some Instagram questions here about Australia and about just personal questions that were sent in that we can probably talk about and answer. You were telling me this really cool story about the Greek guy from Beau Morris. Do you want to get that recorded? You're allowed to say no if you don't want
to. I'm allowed to say no.
Yeah. I just thought it was an amazing story.
Only the names will be changed to protect the innocent.
Well, you can just use first names. Yeah, you were telling. I don't know how this came up. What came up?
I don't know what we were talking about at the time, but no, there was a shop owner in around the suburb that I lived in when I was in my teens and early 20s, and a couple of the local hoods, teenage morons, chucked a brick through the front window of the shop, and this is the window was the full width and height. It was the full height and width of the front of the shop, so it was a huge window. And the guy who ran the place, this is at 2 o'clock in the morning and they were still open, so he was there, and he just walked outside, grabbed the next kid that walked past and said, "Do you know those two?" And the kid packed his dacks, so to speak.
Do you want to explain what that means?
Shat himself. Packed his dacks. Filled his dacks
and
full said, of poo.
And actually gave them the kids' names and their addresses, and he turned up at this address at 3 o'clock in the morning and banged on the door until somebody opened it and said, "Your sons have just thrown a brick through my window. It's going to cost $10,000 to fix. And if anybody ever does it again, you're responsible." And he got his $10,000. But, I think it helped where he was renowned for knowing people who knew people who would do things if required.
Was there a lot more of that back in the day, or do you think that's still around today?
Oh, look, certainly where I grew up. When I grew up, and if there's anybody listening to this who's my age, I'm in my 60s, you would remember that when decimal currency first came in on Australia.
Assuming they were here at the time.
just telling you that, the $10 notes, the original $10 notes, there was a big scam of people making fake ones.
Yeah.
And they were being made in a garage about 100 metres up the road from where I live.
What was the deal? The $10 note was on, I take it was paper, obviously.
Well, it was paper. And they were reasonably good quality in a sense that you couldn't-
The fakes just, or the originals?
The fakes, if you just quickly looked at it, you couldn't tell the difference. But the quality of the paper wasn't as good. They felt different. But if you had two or three of them in your hand, you wouldn't have taken much notice.
Yeah.
So the paper quality was a bit different. The print was not quite as good, and it was missing the metal thread that runs through the old paper notes that we had.
Was that intentionally there?
And it was missing that. So everybody for about a year in Melbourne in particular, whenever they got a $10 note, you handed a $10 note in a shop, the shopkeeper would hold it up to the light to see if they could see the metal thread running through the paper. That guy was just up the road from us, and he was making these notes in his backyard job.
Let's have a look. So, what would you call it? Like $10 note
forgeries.
Forgery. And what would it have been? The 1960s.
Late 1960s.
1960s. I wonder if they probably sell the fake ones online.
Oh, I'm sure they probably do. They're collector's items
Sure. What have we got? 1968. Cache of fake $10 notes found in chimney.
Yeah. In Beau Morris.
This was Mount Waverley.
The guy was originally making them was in Beau Morris.
Formerly occupied by Dale Andrew Code, 37, who was convicted of forgery in November last year and is now serving a 10-year jail sentence. A police search at the house yesterday failed to find the counterfeit plates, which have been hunted throughout Australia. Okay, so assuming this is the guy that it was connected to that was doing it, he'd obviously gotten actual $10 plates
he made
from
them.
Someone.
He made
really?
Them. Yeah. Yeah, that was the whole point. Is he,
wow.
He had a printing press. He made his own plates.
Wow.
And got the paper and inks and things and had a printing press in his garage and was making these forged $10 notes.
The plates were used to print forgeries with a face value of $1 million. Mm. The fake bills flooded Australia in late 1966 and early last year. So, that would have been 1967 at the time.
Yep.
The charred notes were found in Mr. Kevin Walker, who has rented the house for the past 13 months. Wow. So, he obviously tried to burn them or something and left them in the fireplace.
Yeah.
Or they went up the chimney.
Yeah. And then, so apart from the guy who was forging $10 notes.
Why not $100 notes?
We didn't have $100 notes at the time. We only went up to 20. And obviously, the tens he thought were either, you can see, the thing is that the reason in the 60s that we went up to $20 and didn't go any higher is that $20 is a lot of money.
Well, it was probably more than $100
in today's money. Right? And so, yeah, $10, $20 notes, you couldn't have used that much. Tens you could use.
Yeah.
Because you know, your average thing that you would be transacting cash for on a one note item, would have been less than $20. So you could use tens quite easily. And they may well have been easier to forge or whatever. But the other family that was there owned the local greengrocer's shop, the fruit and vegetable shop.
Yeah.
And two of their sons ended up getting killed, shot and killed. They were running the dodgy side of the Footscray vegetable market, basically the mafia in Melbourne. And they ended up being shot. So we had some also interesting characters in our suburb when I was a kid growing up.
Did you know much about what was going on in Lygon Street in the early 2000s and the late 90s with Underbelly? Was that those guys?
Yeah, they were two of the guys in, the movie or the TV series Underbelly was based on the sort of Italian organized crime families in Melbourne.
And
one of the families was these guys, the two older brothers who were running this circus.
Oh, the Morans.
The Morans. Well, they weren't the Italians.
No.
Benvenutos were the name of the...
Oh, really? The Venutos?
The Benvenutos, Jesus. Yeah.
Because I remember, the Morans got done, the two brothers.
Mm.
I think that was that crazy story of... In the TV show, they actually obviously include this story, but Carl Williams is the one in the show, right, and in real life, who was the... He effectively worked for the Morans making them ecstasy, so he had a pill press... I think in his house that he gotten or, and then I think he was competing with them originally, but then started working for them. But he had eyes bigger than his stomach and wanted to take over the place effectively. And so he ended up making heaps of money from ecstasy and then just paying the tattooed kid. What's his name? Benny or something. You'll have to look it up, guys. You'll see it. But this guy who became really good friends with him to just assassinate all these different people in the underbelly that were coming after him. And he was sort of, Carl Williams was kind of paranoid, so just went crazy. But he crossed the line, and I think with the Morans, he had one of them shot in his front yard in front of his kids.
Yeah.
And then the other one was picking up his kids from
a soccer match.
Soccer match or a football game and was waiting in the van.
Yeah.
And the kids were in the van, in the back of the van. And the guy that they had paid to kill one of the Morans, the one of the brothers, I think, and again, I might be confusing this, but it definitely did happen, whether it was the Morans or not. But he was... He had a sawn-off shotgun up his sleeve and he ran a kilometre and a half, like sprinted it, to get to the van, shoot the guy, just walked up, tapped on the window and then bang, killed the two people who were in the front seats and then ran again back a kilometre and a half. So, he was this crazy fit guy, but he had this insane way of actually getting to the game without being noticed by driving up in a car or anything because they had people around. So, a good TV show to sort of understand some of the... crime in Australia.
Yeah.
Underbelly. And it was, I think they've got another series, right? The second one or the third one where they were doing the razor gangs.
Yes.
I don't know if it was Sydney or Melbourne, but back in the 1920s where they had those, I guess they would have just been kind of like street punks, gangs at the time that kind of ran brothels and, did betting and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And they carried razor blades and that was what they fought with. But it's... Obviously, is it dramatized a little bit, but a lot of the time, I think they've taken the actual storylines from actual characters that lived in the past. Yeah. And I think with the Razor Gang one, it was crazy because there was these two women that were the heads of different families and they were the ones that were feuding. I think they were originally friends and they started hating each other and that built into this full... They had two empires that were like coming at one another. So was that crazy. Interesting growing up? You actually sort of knew those people?
Well, I did. Yeah, I knew the two younger brothers. I went to school with them. They both became lawyers.
Jeez. Well, yeah, I guess to get them off, right? To get the family.
Well, who knows whether they ended up working for the family or not. I don't know.
That happens so often. There was another one of those TV shows, Narcos or whatever, and they're talking about the Mexican gangs and the drug cartels. And quite often, it's weird that one of those TV shows, when I was watching it, the head of the family is, like, obviously fully in the drug world and the gang world and, you know, ordering executions and all that sort of crap. But sometimes they have children that they want to keep on the straight and narrow and they want untouched.
Yes.
I think, yeah, it was one of the Colombian drug lords. He had a son that he effectively kept out of it so that he could become a lawyer.
Right.
And then the son keeps getting dragged into trying to protect his dad.
Yeah.
As his dad starts getting taken down. So, it's this stuff, I don't know, I find this sort of endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, it's all a bit bizarre, isn't it? It's so beyond your own experience that you sit there. It's like it's not real. It's like somebody wrote a TV script or something, but it's actually real life.
Yeah, well, that world's so foreign to me, obviously. I don't know, I guess that's just my privileged upbringing and not being around in those sorts of environments where you fall in with that crowd and, you know, I guess from a young age, they just end up having confrontations with the police or with the law enforcement, and they go down the road of it's just easier to be a criminal than for me to try and, you know, and that you probably build up this resentment to the law because they get targeted unfairly or, you know, the whole Ned Kelly kind of thing.
Syndrome. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to explain that?
Oh, yeah. How long's a piece of string?
Well, and there's a good one. If you want to find out more about Australian history and you're interested in those sort of, it would be some of the most, the earliest organized crime, you know, it's the mid-1800s, late 1870s.
Yeah. Ned Kelly was what's commonly called a bushranger. He wasn't particularly a bushranger.
Through the bush.
Yes, he did, but he wasn't, the typical idea of an Australian bushranger was somebody who was sort of, living completely in secret out in the bush and, holding up people as they were, on their horseback or on coaches and things and robbing them on
the expression?
Road. So, stand and deliver.
Stand and deliver. Yeah. That's where that comes from, right?
Yeah, where they'd just hold up a coach and say, stand and deliver meant stop and deliver or give me all of your money and goods that are worth money. But, Ned Kelly was a sort of, his family were petty crims in southern New South Wales and northern Victoria.
And they were Irish migrants.
They were Irish migrants. And,
which meant they were
his
Catholics.
His father
and they were kind
died
targeted,
when
right?
he was young. So his mother sort of ran the family and, a lot of kids, didn't have any money and, they were being targeted by the police. And, there was no question that they were petty criminals, but they were being targeted by the police. But long story short.
And the police
short,
were corrupt back
oh,
then.
Oh, yeah.
Massively
of course they
corrupt.
Were. Long story short, he and a few of his mates end up shooting a policeman.
Well, they don't shoot him. They bash him, don't they?
Well,
initially.
They kill him.
The first one instigates the whole thing. He's drunk coming after Ned Kelly's sister. And they effectively beat him up and tell him to fuck off.
And
then he says that he was shot or targeted by Ned Kelly for not doing anything. And that sets off the police.
And so then the police went out after him and Ned and a few, and his mates, his so-called gang,
the Kelly gang
ended up out in the bush, and the police approached them, and then Ned ended up shooting one of them.
He executed one, I think, at least. There were multiple that died,
And then he was in the end he was hunted down, and Ned Kelly's last stand was this is the famous part where he created a set of armor, iron plate, shoulders, chest, and helmet, And ended up being shot in the legs because he didn't protect his legs from the armor.
He got shot 29 times or something.
And taken to court and found guilty and was hanged in Melbourne, old Melbourne jail.
And this is why you'll see on the back of a lot of cars, such as life, in quotes.
And that's what his alleged last words were, whatever you want to say, and he said, such is life.
Yeah.
It's not known whether that was actually his last words, but that's what's become the famous quote.
And you can go to Melbourne jail and see an imprint of his face, right? The death mask.
The death mask. And say Beechworth jail up in country Victoria has got some stuff as well. So.
Or is it Glen Rowan? Is that where
Glen Rowan was where the last stand was.
And that pub's still there, isn't it? Or the place where
the location is still there,
yeah.
Yeah.
That it burnt down. They set fire to it.
Yeah, and I don't even know whether it's still there, but there used to be this really kitsch sort of reenactment with animatronics reenactment of the whole story. It's cute in terms of showing you the story, but it was fairly sort of amateurish. But that was 30 years ago. I don't know whether it's still there.
Well, and this is one of these funny stories or, I guess, pop culture kind of parts of Australia. Of Australianism, right? Of what it is to be Australian. You'll get a lot of the the lower class parts of society that associate more with Ned Kelly and see him as a sort of innocent, targeted by the cops guy. And he was a hero, and went out like a martyr.
Yes.
And then you'll have the other side of it where it's like he murdered people.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. He was a crim and he ended up murdering policemen. Yeah,
and so, obviously the truth's probably somewhere between the two.
Well, I think both sides are true. It's not even that it's somewhere in between. Both are true. He ended up falling into that life because his family were being targeted unfairly.
Yeah.
If the Kelly family had just been left alone to, run their little farm and, steal a horse occasionally on the side, then nobody probably would have noticed. But the fact was that, they were unfairly picked on. But at the same time, he did kill people. So.
Yeah, well, and then he went on a sort of rampage of just robbing banks, right? But giving the money to the people that were sort of helping him hide in the bush because he became
this sort of Robin Hood character of robbing banks and giving the money away, but it was giving money away to help people, to protect him.
So. Yeah, and he wrote a massive letter, didn't he?
Yeah, the Girildry letter.
Where he calls everyone, was that a wombat?
No, he was calling the police. Yeah, fat-headed wombats or something. It's actually very clever when you read it. You just sit there and go, this is the greatest string of insults ever written.
So. He'd be one of those guys that would be like, I'd have dinner with this guy.
Oh, yeah.
I'd love to hear it, wouldn't he?
Yeah,
I imagine he would have told some tall stories, but it would have been interesting to hear his take on things.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
But it is a funny thing where when he was being hunted down at the end, right, with the Kelly gang, so he had his, I think, brothers and friends that were also in the armour and, they'd made their own versions and they had guns and everything and were hiding in the, whatever it was, the pub or-
Glen Rowan Hotel.
Yeah. They had the police coming out from-
Melbourne.
From Melbourne on the train. Yeah. And there would have been, I think, 50 or more policemen coming out and they tried to derail the train by removing part of the-
Part of the
train line. Yeah. They removed it, but- I think someone escaped from the pub when they were holding up the pub with the people in there. Exactly. And waved down the train. That guy ended up being the great-grandfather of one of my teachers, my English teacher.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at school. And I was always like, amazing. Damn, what does it feel like to have a coward?
Yeah, Judas.
Exactly. But then you're like, he saved, dozens of lives.
Exactly.
By doing that.
And a lot of innocent lives, too.
Exactly. I think he was the school teacher of that play, of Glen Rowan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, at the time. So, he was the guy that effectively caused Ned Kelly to be caught, captured, and then hanged. But yeah, all by the age of 25 too. Blows my mind. You grow up learning about these characters and you see these photos of them with beards and you're like, he's old as. And then all of a sudden, I'm 34 and I'm just like, Jesus, the guy died at 25. That's fucked. Like, far out. What a tragic kind of life. So was he looked up to quite a lot when you were younger or?
Yeah, looked up to in a sense that people recognised him as an interesting character, I think. And there has always been that dichotomy, as we've been talking about, is that, was he a relatively innocent person who was being picked on and driven to crime?
Yeah.
Or was he just a criminal who ended up getting worse and worse and deserved what he got? But I know, and you and I both went through the University of Melbourne and certainly when I was there in the 1970s on, the day that Ned Kelly or the anniversary of Ned Kelly's hanging, there always used to be protests outside the Redmond Barry building.
Oh, really?
At the university because Sir Redmond Barry was the judge who sentenced him to death.
Oh, I didn't realise.
Yeah.
Because I went to these buildings for classes when I was at uni.
Yeah, so it was a science building in one of the science buildings in the University of Melbourne.
Yeah.
Biology prac classes and tutorials and lectures and things were held in that building. But there always used to be protests. They were fairly minor protests. A few people putting up, free Ned Kelly signs and things around there, 100 years later.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a thing, but I think that was around the centenary, the 100 years since he was killed. And so that was sort of a big thing in the press around then. I'm sure the same thing doesn't happen now.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, like, you think, who's going to be the Ned Kelly of the 2000s? You know, I can't imagine there being a someone like that in our...
Julian Assange.
I guess. Well, fuck me. And what happened recently? The CIA came out with a plan to try and assassinate him, or at least...
Somebody had asked them to come up with a plan. Whether they did it or not, I don't
know. No, they didn't try and do it, but they'd had one for trying to kill him. How do you feel? How do you sit on that, where... It is a weird thing, right, where Julian Assange, from what I understand, and I have a pretty limited understanding of his background, but he was sent the documents for WikiLeaks from whistleblowers and happened to be the person behind WikiLeaks.
Who published them.
And it's just been such a weird... The US is just like, we need to get this guy. He needs to go down. Yeah. And, like, I've heard... They were trying to get him for treason, and you're like, he's not an American citizen.
No.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it can't be treason. It's American politics is sort of weird in that sense of, and there's a whole litany for, you know, a century or more of stories around, people who have been persecuted for doing things that you, at face value, we've got whistleblowers who are identifying that the country, under whatever form, whether it's, you know, the government directly or whether it's the CIA or the FBI or whoever it happens to be, whistleblowers who are identifying that these people are doing something against the law.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case reasonably recently, or at least it's come out recently, I think it's a few years old, of a woman who was getting information about the CIA doing things, CIA and the FBI, putting wires on people's phones.
And that was Edward Snowden, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, that was one. Yeah,
he was doing that too.
Yeah, 40, 50 years ago. But, and she was completely persecuted. But they kept doing it on the grounds of this is national security. And the whistleblowers are saying, but it's not, you can't just call national security when you want to hide something.
Yeah.
You have to prove to a judge, and it could be in camera in the sense that it's hidden. It's one of those weird things that in camera actually means not in camera.
Is that an expression?
In camera is an expression that actually means hidden.
As in one word?
Yeah.
As in a negative camera?
Yeah. It's in camera, but it actually means to be hidden away in the dark. So this whole idea that, you can persecute anybody, and jail them without, trial or anything else because they have broken national security is something that, a lot of countries do it. And I'm sure there are countries like Russia and China and North Korea that, they just go out and shoot you. They don't bother with, we'll take you to court and everything else. But, Americans seem to have this sort of bizarre thing about, we can do anything under the guise of national security. And I think that's getting back to your original question. I think that's the challenge that I have with Julian Assange is that and I haven't even looked at or read any of the stuff that he supposedly leaked.
A lot of that was the drone strikes, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But none of this is about national security. This was reports on things that had happened in the past. This is not saying, he's leaking plans to bomb North Korea. These were things that had happened in the past and the documentation had been leaked. So where's the national security in establishing that something that actually was done illegally by the government 10 years ago? This is just clearly, blocking things when government doesn't want the information to come out. And so I sit on that side of it. The other side of it I sit on is he being Julian Assange, I think he got trapped by his own ambition of, this was a, hey, I've got a chance here to blow the lid on a few things. And he was just stupid. He should have looked at this and said, this is way too big. I'm not going to touch it. But I think the idea of fame got to him, and
he seems like a he's little put up bit with
20 years of his own narcissism being sitting in a now a cell in jail, but originally in the Ecuadorian, well, he was in Russia for a year or two, and then in the Ecuadorian embassy.
But didn't he get arrested in Sweden for rape or something? And those were trumped up charges, from what I understand. Yeah. And then they extradited him to the UK, and then
he escaped and ended up. This is you got to look at it and go, seriously, if this guy's the world's biggest criminal, as the Americans were trying to put him out as, how does he end up in London and end up escaping and going to, for all places, the Ecuadorian embassy? I'm sure it was just the first non European embassy that he could find.
Yeah.
And he ended up in there, and he was there for, a decade or so, and now he's in jail.
But
no, it's a bizarre story. But yeah, he's that sort of Ned Kelly thing of, on one side, he's a criminal who has, done the worst things imaginable to, government security. On the other side, he's the honest whistleblower who's trying to do the right thing.
Well, not even that, right? Like, he's just the one who published what the whistleblowers gave him.
Exactly.
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because the US just seemed to have been like, what's the expression? A dog with a bone, right? They just would not let him go.
And it's a witch hunt in the end. Yeah. Now it's just become one of those
It's saving face, right?
It is. We went so hard at this. We need to get him. And I think most Americans would just sit there and say, who?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the assassination thing just seems so stupid, because it's like, well,
why?
If you killed him, who do you think everyone's going to think did it?
Yeah. And why? What do you get out of this?
Yeah.
It's like he's not doing it again. You're not protecting your national security by killing somebody who's in jail.
It's nuts.
Have you seen him lately?
Who?
Footage of
Julian Assange. Yeah. He looks raggedy.
He looks like he's 70 years old.
Yeah, and he's got a huge beard that's grey. I mean, and I can imagine he's probably aged immaturely, right?
Yeah.
Because of stress.
Yeah, exactly.
You see Obama, right? Obama before and after.
Yeah. In 8 years.
And he's just gone grey.
Yeah.
Like, I can imagine from the stress. Oh, man. All right, let's get on to some of these questions from people.
Go for it.
What have we got here? This one comes from Tehran. If you could change where you live in the blink of an eye without any effort, where would you be? So you could live anywhere, I guess, is the point.
If I could live anywhere, funnily enough, I'd probably live where I live.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty tepid, Dad.
I know.
It's pretty weak.
It's lame, isn't it?
All right. Where would you live? You could live anywhere in the blink of an eye, and it's not where you currently live.
It's not where you currently live. Yeah, so you're not allowed to answer what you actually think. You tell me what you make one up.
Well, surely there's a second place. And you're like, next door.
Yeah, next door, exactly. Yeah, I'd pull down next door's house and make a tennis court next to our place. Genuinely, I think I would live in Australia.
Australia's a big place.
It is.
Plenty of options that aren't Ocean Grove.
I know, but I'd live somewhere on the coast in Australia, maybe on the south coast of New South Wales. I just like the climate. I like the people. Everything about it.
And so you're not a man who likes.
I'm not going to go. I'm going to live in Monte Carlo, and that's the other thing. If you said you can live anywhere you like, but you can have the financial wherewithal to enable you to live any way you would like, that would probably be different. Because I'll go and live in Monte Carlo and I'll be able to afford a hotel room for about 3 days, and then I've got to go away and home, wherever that might be, given that I've given up home.
Maybe I guess the question
should be- So where would you go?
Well, maybe the question should be, if you could open your front door and you're in any location, right, and it's self-sustained, the house is paid off, you can afford to live there, is there a part of Australia you would prefer to be living in than Ocean Grove? Because I can imagine there must be hundreds, thousands of places along the coast that would be better than Ocean Grove.
Yeah, but- better in some circumstances, but not others.
A nice forest behind your house. There are places
that are places that are prettier. You can go, down the Great Ocean Road. They're prettier than where we live, but they're further away from Melbourne. Not that we've been able to go to Melbourne for the last 6 months, but there are places that have got milder winters, but they've got shitty summers. Ideally, you'd sit there and look at it and go, well, I'd live on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland in winter, and I'd live in Victoria in summer.
Yeah.
But then the Sunshine Coast in winter for the last 2 or 3 years has been awful because it's rained. It never used to rain. I grew up where people would say, what's the weather going to be like in southern Queensland? It'll be 23 degrees and it won't rain.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's 23 degrees and it rains.
More moisture in the air.
Yeah, exactly.
Climate change.
So, Yeah, it is a bizarre thing. Or hails
as recently, right? Did you see that with a massive baseball-sized hail?
I know,
zones.
Yeah, I think exactly.
It was an Australia record.
It was in Queensland.
16 centimetres across.
Yeah, size of a softball.
Fuck that.
I know.
That would kill you if you were outside.
Yeah, basically.
It would fucking kill you. Imagine that falling out of the sky at terminal velocity, 200 k's an hour, and just smacks you in the back of the head.
Funnily enough, I got an email from my insurance company saying, actually, it wasn't an email. It was a text message when there was a thunderstorm and lightning warning for Ocean Grove.
Mm.
I got a text message from our insurance company
for our car
insurance saying, have you got your cars undercover?
Yeah.
Because it's,
well, that saves
it's
them
going
money
to cost
and
them money.
Money.
Yeah. It's going to cost them money if we end up with hailstone damage. Now,
mm-hmm.
We haven't had 16 centimetre. Well, nowhere in Australia that's had 16
fucked.
Centimetre
I
hailstone.
I can't imagine. Like, that's literally bigger than my fist, right? By probably one of my fists and a half.
Yeah, it's about the size of a softball for people who know what a softball looks like.
That's, it's the kind of thing where if you were holding this hailstone, which is effectively just ice, you could hold your hand open
and
it would weigh about
a kilogram and a half.
Yeah, and these were falling from the sky. And you can imagine walking. Imagine being caught outside with that happening.
No.
You're just like, it looks like it's going to rain. And then all of a sudden,
you're beaten to death.
Yeah.
Nobody died. Which I'm astounded with.
I reckon a lot of kangaroos died.
Oh, yeah, right. No humans have been recorded as being
imagine how many birds got fucked up.
I know.
Just sitting on
their little skinny branch hiding under the leaf.
I can't imagine the wildlife just get mauled by this huge thing.
It was a bit weird. So, where would you live if you had the choice of anywhere to go?
Well, I'm trying to think of that at the moment, and this is the sort of situation that I'm stuck in, and I've been whinging to you about it, trying to buy a house and work out where to buy. I have, enough income to probably spend $600,000 to $700,000 on a house, which may get me a 3 to 4 bedroom house in suburbia like Curlewis here, which is, first world problems. It's not the worst thing in the world, but ideally, I grew up with a view of the beach in Ocean Grove, and even though I never really went to the beach that much, just knowing it's there.
Yeah, funny about
hearing
that.
Hearing it at night. Yeah, I don't know. And the coast, being close to the beach, I think there is something weird about that where, I don't know if it was your moving us to the beach when we were kids and us growing up there that sort of just, I just want to be by the beach. I can't imagine living in somewhere like, even inland by a few hours drive. Even, imagine living in Alice Springs. I'd be like, this is hell. There's no beach.
Yeah, yeah.
This is about
it's
as
2 days
away
drive
from the beach.
To get to the beach.
Don't get the fish and chips.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I've been trying to work out, I don't have a job where I need to be in a specific location because all I need is an internet connection, but I have small children and I want them to be close to their family. Mm. Where I currently live, I can spend the money on getting a house, not in my original suburb that I grew up in, but one outside that is-
And only 15 minutes away.
Yeah. That's close by, but it's not, there's no established trees around, really. It's kind of just literally you look outside in your backyard and you're just surrounded by a sea of houses. Yeah. And so, again, it's first world problems, but I would really love to have a forest nearby, more wildlife nearby, a beach within walking distance. And so, working out, do you sort of sacrifice family and living in a place with cities nearby or with, the amenities and all the other things you're used to, or do you go rural? Where you can afford to spend $600,000 to $700,000 get yourself a freaking mansion on an acre block and near a beach where you're going to have fewer people and you can just hang out.
But then you'll get bushfires
every
10 years that, threaten your life.
Yeah. Well, and go now after Black Saturday, right? Or Black Summer.
Yeah, we get 50 years to those places.
That's it. We've got a head start.
Yes.
So, I don't know. I was looking at some of the coast along the east coast, obviously, of Australia. I think, I was whinging to you the other night about Pambula and Marimbula, which look beautiful.
Yeah, but they're priced out.
Yeah. But I mean, not talking about price, we're talking about just in where you live.
Yeah. Yeah. South coast of New South Wales is as pretty as you can get.
Yeah.
As is, the Great Ocean Road, the Surf Coast in Victoria.
Yeah.
It's as pretty as you can get.
Eden is pretty nice. But again, it's just, these are beautiful places along the coast, and the ones you can afford are usually a long way from anywhere with schools and everything. Yeah, so, exactly. You would be isolated. But I don't know. Yeah, I think I would probably live somewhere like maybe Noosa.
Mm. So, have you been to Noosa recently?
Not well. I mean, probably 10 years ago.
Again,
I mean, location-wise, I don't-
Location, it's great.
Yeah.
But Noosa is now a circus.
What's the other
place? It's like a busy suburb of Sydney or Melbourne.
What's the other place full of hippie weirdos that don't get vaccinated? along the
Byron Bay.
Byron Bay. Yeah. That would probably be, you know, the place of like, this is where I would love to live. It's
full of rich hippie weirdos.
Yeah. And poor ones that live out of vans.
Yeah, but they're not living in Byron Bay. They're living up in the hinterland.
Yeah.
If you want to live near the beach.
So, yeah, I don't know, somewhere on the coast with forest and surf, where you've got the forest nearby so that you can go walking in it, and there's a lot of wildlife nearby. And then you've got the beach as well, so that you can at least hear the ocean, see it, smell it.
Waterfalls.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Anywhere along the coast that would be sort of like that. If it was outside of Australia, where would you live?
I'd live in Canada or New Zealand.
Okay. Outside of Australia in a non-English-speaking country.
Oh, non-English-speaking country. Scotland. They don't speak English in Scotland.
You mean northern Scotland, northern where they Scotland. Still speak Gaelic?
Yeah, they still speak Gaelic, none of which I speak, but... no, I would probably live somewhere in Europe, but I haven't been to continental Europe, in non-English speaking Europe, so I couldn't tell you where, other than by reputation and guessing. If I were to guess, I would probably say somewhere on the coast of France or Spain.
Yeah.
Because I can speak enough French that I think I could learn it. And same with Spanish, that it wouldn't be completely foreign. I reckon in 3 months I could be speaking enough to be able to survive there. Whereas if I moved to Germany, it would take me 3 years.
Basque country would be pretty cool on the border between Spain and France, where you could learn all three of those languages. Yeah,
exactly.
And Basque is this weird isolate that isn't related to any of the European languages.
Yeah, they want to keep being independent. Spain won't let them. Yeah.
Oh, no, I think that's I don't know if that might be Basque, but that's the Catalan, right?
Oh, Catalonia does.
They're the
well.
Ones that really want to get their independence, and I think they're I don't know if it's their prime minister or whatever got put in jail recently.
Well, and again, that's where all the money's in Barcelona, Barcelona.
Yeah. Is that what's the money from?
It's just
the economic center.
It's the economic center. It's not the capital of the country, but it's the biggest city financially, I believe.
Yeah,
never been there.
So you'd live in New Zealand too, really?
Oh, yeah, New Zealand's paradise.
There's earthquakes.
Yeah, but
just live in the north.
Well, there's earthquakes in the north as well, but volcanoes. Well, people killed in a volcano just offshore from Auckland.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
So. I'd live in New Zealand, but it's just full of New Zealanders.
Yeah, well, the second biggest New Zealand city in the world?
Melbourne.
Sydney.
Yeah.
It is. There are more people born in New Zealand who live in Sydney than... it used to be Christchurch, but after the big earthquakes there a few years ago, the population went down by about 100,000 people.
Yeah.
Not that 100,000 people died, but a lot of people left when their houses got destroyed and just never came back. So.
All right. Let's go to the next question.
We spent a lot of time on that one. We'll be here until midnight.
We can do an hour or two.
Yeah.
Australians are so nice to strangers. However, I think it's just pretending and they don't mean it, right?
No, wrong.
How would you answer that one?
Wrong.
Yeah? You reckon they mean it?
Yeah.
I think it probably depends on the Australian.
No, there's no reason to pretend. I think it's one of those ones where... And I've travelled a lot in North America, in Canada, in the United States.
Where they do pretend.
Where they... A lot of... Well, most Americans are really nice people, and Canadians are pathologically nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, Canada's the only country I've ever been with where every second sentence starts with sorry. They apologise before they've said or done something as if it's going to insult you. But it's not that they don't mean it. Well, Canadians are a bit different. But in the United States, it's not that Americans don't mean it when they're being nice to you. But it is so practiced and superficial that you just go... It's that, the McDonald's have a nice day after they've given you your change and served you. You go, well, who are you to tell me what to do? Instead of that one. But
is that related to the fact that they don't have a minimum wage and they require tipping?
That service thing of tipping and so on, I think is, sorry, I'm about to have a drink here.
So you think as a result of the fact that your wage probably depends on being tipped in a lot of these sorts of jobs, artificially polite.
So there is that sort of, that's that artificial politeness in the service industry. But I think most Americans are just artificially nice. They call people sir and madam and,
That is weird.
That I've is, but it's just built in. Times. It's just built in. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with it. But I sit there and look at it and go, that's fake. Which is probably the same as the reaction as the question I had.
Yeah.
But I think Australians genuinely mean it. And certainly one of the differences and something that if you listen to some of the episodes of The Goss, another series that Pete and I do on video.
Probably heard about it.
Probably heard about it, yeah.
Scroll down, you'll find it.
Scroll down, you'll find it. I've talked a lot about the distinction between Melbourne and Sydney, the two biggest cities in the country. And
yeah.
It's 25 million people live in Australia, and more than 10 million of them live in Melbourne and Sydney.
Yeah,
they're all just the bad over ones 5 million each. And there's this huge rivalry, and there has been ever since Melbourne was created. So Melbourne was created in the late 1830s, and so that's 50 years after Sydney was created. But Melbourne rapidly became the biggest city in Australia and the richest city in the world
yep.
when the Victorian Gold Rush happened in the 1850s, which was only 14 years after Melbourne was created. And so there's been this Melbourne-Sydney rivalry thing where Sydney have always considered themselves to be the original city, the big city, the real capital of Australia before Canberra was created.
Yeah.
Melbourne became a bigger city, a richer city, and then it became the capital of Australia for 20-something years after Federation and before Canberra was built. Canberra is a built capital city.
Yeah.
And so there's always been this rivalry of, which is the better city and so on. And the old gag is that, people in Sydney think they live in the best city in the world.
And
people in Melbourne know they live in the best city in the world. And Melbourne has regularly been rated, whatever those rating means, and it's just, puffing out your chest and boasting. It's meaningless anyway of, the most livable city in the world.
I'd love to know more about the criteria.
I know. And they're probably reasonable criteria, but... And Sydney is always close. It's not like there's a huge difference.
Yeah.
But in relation to the question that you asked, and I've actually tested this out, and I've seen it, anecdotally and observationally a lot. If you were a visitor in Australia and you went to Sydney and you were standing on a street corner and you opened up a map, you can almost guarantee the first handful of people in Sydney, the thing that they would say to you would be, get out of the fucking way, because they're running around. They're always in a rush. Yeah. You can guarantee in Melbourne, the first thing people would say is, do you need a hand? Can I help you?
Someone should do that as a study.
Yeah.
If you guys are traveling
through
Australia,
it's the difference between the two places.
You should try that for yourselves and get back to me. You should literally take a map out. If you plan to go to
Melbourne, stand on a street corner in the central business district, the center of the city.
Just for a few hours.
Yeah. Or even 20 minutes and just see how.
Exactly.
And it's just a difference. Now, it's an exaggerated difference, but there's a difference in that. And I think Melbourne people are nicer and friendlier, but then maybe it's just because I grew up there and lived there for 40 years.
Sydney felt claustrophobic to me when I
was there. It does. And it's just busier and claustrophobic. And part of that is the city structure itself, that Melbourne was a planned city and that the central business district of Melbourne was laid out on a nice grid with wide open streets and wide
bullock
roads.
Bullock trays to turn around.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas Sydney was just literally the old, the little cobbled laneways of the original village that was created there.
We'll just add this on. We'll add this on.
And now it's got all the same tall buildings that Melbourne has, but you go into the street and they're dark.
Yeah.
Because it's very rare that the sun will get to them, whereas Melbourne streets are much more open and they got trees in them and so on. So,
What does it say here? Sydney is larger, but Melbourne is growing faster. While Sydney is larger with a population of 4.8 million, Melbourne is growing at a rate that is 18% faster, meaning it will be Australia's largest city by 2050. There are a few different things here. There's some articles from The Guardian and news.com.au from the end of last year and this year saying that modelling from the centre of population predicts Melbourne's population will overtake Sydney by 2026.
Yeah.
It's only 5 years away when it's expected to get to 6.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think Australia will look like if Melbourne overtakes Sydney in size? Will that change the balance of things? Because it seems like when I watch the news, politics and what goes on in Australia business-wise seems to always be centred on Sydney.
Yeah, so you've grown up in the last 10 years, though, with Liberal National Party Conservative governments.
Yeah.
That primarily the Liberal Party is primarily based, certainly
Sydney.
In the federal Liberal Party is primarily based in New South Wales. So it's just very Sydney-centric thing. Whereas, funnily enough, the ALP is a Victorian thing. Sydney and New South Wales are still bigger than Victoria in number of people, but there are more senior ALP people who tend to come from Victoria, and the reverse is true in New South Wales. So I think that's the case, is when we're talking federal politics at the moment, and the joke is that Scott Morrison is the Prime Minister for New South Wales because all the decisions and things that he seems to do seem to favour New South Wales, which happens to have a Liberal state government, whereas the other two big states, Victoria and Queensland have left-wing governments, and so they're not going to get anything out of the federal government, and the federal government is always going to be disagreeing with the premiers of Victoria and New South Wales, sorry, Victoria and Queensland, and agreeing with the premier of New South Wales. So yeah, it's a bit bizarre. But
I've sent Kel a message to try and bring me a Pepsi. Because I can't get out. Dad's standing between me, or sitting between me and
my
the door.
I never met my Scottish grandmother, but I think she would have said to you, Pete, you're a disgrace.
Yeah, that's it. We got a question here from Natty, and she asks, I believe it's a she, is it difficult to adopt a baby in Australia?
Yes.
And is surrogacy normal in Australia? Is it difficult to adopt a baby? Yeah.
I don't know anything about surrogacy in Australia. I mean, intellectually, I know what it is, but I don't know.
Do you want to explain what it is for anyone who doesn't know?
Well, yeah, surrogacy is where a couple will have another woman get impregnated with their embryo, and carry the pregnancy and then hand the baby back to them at the end of that when it's born. There are people who do
going
it
through that.
I know.
Me. Talk about an emotional roller coaster.
And they get paid for it, but.
But even that, right? Like, you literally are giving birth to a human being that, weirdly enough, isn't related to you, potentially, assuming that it wasn't your egg.
Well, a lot of surrogates are related, but it's not your egg. But
as in, you're
it could
the
be the woman's sister or cousin or something.
Yeah, but how some weird is that, of giving birth to a child that isn't biologically your daughter
and then
or
handing
son.
It off to someone else.
Yeah, and then the whole thing of, emotionally, you've had this thing grow inside you for nine and a half months, and you give birth to it, and then you're severed.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, there's Kel. Thank you.
Yeah. He's telling me he's a disgrace.
Thanks, Kelly. She's got a mouthful of food. Charm one more. Obrigado. I love these episodes now because I feel like I don't have to actually...
You don't have to do anything. You just sit around and get me to talk so and your easier. Wife to wait on you.
It's so much easier when you don't have to worry about transcribing the episode. So, surrogacy is difficult in Australia. I don't even know if that's legal.
It exists. Yeah, it exists, but I don't know anything about it in terms of difficulty and legal requirements and so on. So
altruistic surrogacy is legal in most Australian states and territories. Well, okay, most. Okay, so there's places it potentially isn't. Commercial surrogacy is where the surrogate mother makes a profit from the arrangement. That is, she is paid more than the cost of medical and legal expenses. Yeah, and I don't think that's allowed.
No, it's illegal.
I think and the reason that's illegal here is because we're worried about exploitation of people, right?
Yes.
You're worried that you're going to end up with people
finding
in a position of financial
teenage
need.
Teenage kid saying, hey, I'll give you $100,000 to have my baby.
That's where it gets so dodgy, right? Because you end up with Westerners, well, potentially Australians, going to places like India or Thailand, finding some poor as in not without money, although they probably don't have money if they're willing to do this, but like, you know, a sad situation where they have someone, a woman, obviously, or a young girl in these countries who's, you know, needs money to feed their family. Mm. And they end up, you know, effectively, I mean, I'm sure a lot of these people don't go out there to take advantage of.
No.
But they just want children, right? But they forget that kind of, what would you say, the power imbalance that you've got as a rich white Westerner that goes into a third world country or, at least a third world situation where someone's even willing, you know, it's like selling your kidney, right?
Yeah,
where they have people that do that in certain countries because they need the money to pay for X, Y, Z. And I think there were some horrific stories of them, say, getting the surrogate lined up in, say, India, having them carry the baby to term, have the baby born and they're like, it's got Down syndrome. We don't want it.
We don't want it. It's yours.
Yeah. Well, and they just bail. And then the child tragically ends up not Indian.
Yes.
Because it's, for whatever
it's not
reason.
Ethnically Indian or biologically.
Has no parents, effectively, because the surrogate's like, well, fuck, I don't want this problem. I couldn't afford to take care of myself, which is why I was doing this stupid thing.
Exactly.
Let alone a child with special needs. And then the child just ends up in an orphanage. And so there are these stories of like orphanages that have these effectively abandoned surrogate children that came to term and the parents just changed their mind.
That's horrible. Adoption is quite rare in Australia. There are far more people wanting to adopt than there are adoptive children available.
Now, I was talking about this and I was like, is it because we have a government and social welfare system that's set up to support people so you don't end up with children needing to be adopted in the first place?
Oh, I think
it's what's
part
the
of
reason
that
we don't have children that need to be adopted?
Well, I think it's partly that. I think abortion is pretty much accepted as a a reasonable alternative to carrying a pregnancy for women who don't want to.
Yeah.
Whereas in many other countries in the world, that's not the case.
Yeah.
And so I think there are just fewer children in Australia who are like, there are still a lot of children though who are in the social welfare system who don't necessarily need adopting, but are looking for families to, you know, live with them for, you know, to live there for a few years while they get a change of family circumstances and things. But
I think that's the way that most adoption probably takes place, right? Where you end up as a
you start foster off fostering parent. A child and then end up adopting them.
Yeah. Yeah. In order to give them the stability and family that they want. Because I can't imagine, too, being in a foster situation where you effectively the stereotype is that these children get moved around from family to family, and so they never get a sort of full family parents kind of experience.
Yeah.
I was going to say, do you want to mention the story, too, about Australians adopting foreigners?
Yeah.
That, too, seems like such a weird, from my point of view, a weird situation where I think it probably got made weird after Madonna and all these famous people like Brad Pitt went over to Africa and, you know,
Angelina Jolie. And
you're just like, this seems like you guys are doing this for the brownie points and for the what would you say? The popularity more so than
actually
giving a shit about children who need parents, or else you would look in your own
backyard.
Yeah, it's
weird. To me, that's, yeah, somebody who's, and I'm not denigrating this, for all I know, they could be wonderful parents.
I'm sure they are.
But
especially with the world
looking at
you.
It seems to me that, yeah, if you're worth that sort of money and you're worried about, you know, children in developing countries not having, you know, family circumstances and things, you would be donating money to charities that are allowing people in their own villages and towns to have a better life.
Well, and the thing to pause
than
you
taking
there,
one out of there and bringing them over and sticking them in Hollywood.
Well, that's it. If you're that rich, even rich enough to go through the process of adopting a child, because I'm sure it costs a shitload of money.
Particularly international adoption. Yeah.
Surely you could use that money to get children taken care of and adopted in their own country.
Adopt a village.
Where they learn their own culture, their own language. Because that was the thing that's a bit weird for me of, you know, I guess it's almost like this Western privilege thing of, I think I'm going to go and save one of these children from their situation, the country that they, you know, this poor black country in Africa, and I'm doing the world a favor. And it's almost like this, but are you really? Like, is it what's in the best interest for the child, or is it the biggest difference you could be making with the money that you have?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, that's a subjective judgment that you and I make.
Yeah.
And we can sit on our high horse not being able to afford this, and say, if I had the money, I would be like this. And, you know, that's just pontificating. It may be a reasonable point to make, but, you know, we're not in a position to be able to actually do it. So, but getting back to your point about international adoption, there are plenty of people who adopt children from other countries. I've got a very close friend friends who have adopted, two Korean children. In fact, they got them as newborn babies. And that was because they couldn't find Australian babies. They were interested in adopting newborn babies, not a child that had grown. And, you know, they didn't
and
want
they
a 5-year-old.
Adopted these kids in the 90s or the 80s?
90s.
Yeah.
And these children came from an orphanage in Seoul, in South Korea. And the orphanage was there. Because mostly for single mothers.
Were these the Catholic Koreans or the Christian,
well, Christian
Koreans?
Koreans
the women would just be like, my life's over if I keep this child.
And so these women, and not necessarily young women, although a lot of them are, but single women who end up pregnant, and culturally it was so frowned upon to do that they ended up going to these orphanages, living there for this part of their pregnancy, giving birth, and often looking after the babies there for a while, and then leaving them, and the babies were being adopted simply because their lives were, it was impossible for them to do that outside of that.
It's such a weird situation, right? Because I can't imagine ever being, this is one of those things that, again, it just what makes me feel so privileged to be Australian. Mm. I can't imagine being in a situation where I would think, you know, I really hope some foreigner can come in and adopt my child because they'll have such a better life. Like, if they can just get the hell out of Australia and, you know, go to Japan. Fuck me, I hope there's some Japanese parents who want an Australian baby, you know. And these mothers, I imagine, would have been in that situation of, there's no way that I can take care of this child because culturally I'd be screwed.
Yeah.
But I hope that there's a Westerner or a foreigner that can come and take these kids, or the place that they go to, the orphanage.
Now, what's interesting about that, though, too, is that the South Korean government still support those children.
Yeah.
In that once they have reached the age of 18, the South Korean government will pay them to come back to South Korea and study Korean culture, Korean language, to maintain their culture, even when, you know, they're not saying come back and live here, but they're just saying that we want you to still consider yourself. Yes, you're Australian or Canadian or New Zealand or British or wherever you've ended up, but we want you to still maintain your South Korean culture and language. So it's an interesting one where the government actually say to them, yeah, we recognize that, you know, the circumstances have meant that you've left our country.
Yeah.
But, you know, we want you to come back. And, you know, one of the children in the, you know, parents, their parents are friends of mine. One of those children has done that and gone there and had a great time. And it's actually worked at that orphanage that she was born at.
Wow.
As a volunteer.
Did she ever get to meet her folks or have any connection?
I think she has met her biological mother. They know who she is.
Yeah.
I think she has met her biological mother. I'm not sure. I think there was an intention to, but I can't remember. I'll have to ask her next time I see her.
That'd be a mind fuck. I can't imagine going through that situation too and trying to just deal with that emotion.
Yeah, but it's a little bit different from being abandoned in the traditional sense. I've got a couple of friends who were adopted, you know, and they're now in their 50s.
In Australia.
One in Australia, one in Canada. But they spent, after they found out they were adopted, you know, one of them was in their teens, the other one was a younger child. They had this sort of long-term empty feeling in them about being abandoned.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in the case of the Korean babies in this orphanage, they weren't being abandoned, as in not wanted. They were being given away for a better life, which was very different of, yeah, my mother's not abandoning me because she doesn't love me.
Yeah.
She's giving me away because she loves me. And I think that was a different aspect.
We have a similar situation to that, though, in Australia with the Catholics and the Catholic hospitals, where they would effectively force young women in their 50s and 60s
to give up their babies.
So it was almost exactly the same sort of thing culturally.
It's not like that didn't happen in Australia. That was happening up until the 1960s of young unmarried women who would have a baby in a Catholic hospital. The babies were just taken away from them, and they would have to fight to keep them. It was crazy. So
I wonder if there are some stats on this, because I remember seeing some docos on this, and it was like thousands of children were separated from their parents, effectively forced. Yeah, so the Catholic Church apologizes for the forced adoptions in Australia. Whoa, man, this is fucked. Mothers have described being shackled and sedated as their newborn children were taken away to church-run hospitals, church-run hospitals. Jesus. It's just nuts that could happen in a country like Australia, even in the 60s.
Yeah, and this is in my lifetime.
Yeah.
This is not like happening early 19th century.
Yeah. It is insane, right, that we have so many of these sorts of things under our, skeletons in our closets like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Even, you know, it's sort of like the stolen generation thing, but for Catholic women.
Yeah, well, exactly. And most of these kids, they were kids. Your average 25-year-old, this was not going to happen because they could stand up to it. But, a 15-year-old girl in the 1960s who ends up in a Catholic hospital and has clearly come from a Catholic family and is feeling ashamed already is not going to stand up to a midwife and a doctor who are telling her that they have to give her baby up.
And I guess the reason this is happening at the time, I don't know if abortion was illegal, but Catholics obviously don't believe in abortion.
Well, it was illegal, forbidden. And it was forbidden in Catholic churches and hospitals anyway, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's see if I can find
another question.
Yeah, let's bring it on. some of these are so random. How tall are you?
About this tall. That doesn't work in
this will work for you. Where do you envision you'd be if you hadn't gotten married and become a dad? This is from Anne. So thank you,
Anne. Hey, Anne, thanks for the question. I will assume this means I never got married and never became a dad. Not that I didn't marry...
Become my dad.
And become your dad.
Yeah, well, that's it. If you hadn't married mum, become my dad.
I married somebody else and never married... Yeah, so... Yeah. Where would I be? I'd be a lot wealthier. Or at least I would have had a lot more spending money. I may not still have it, but I might have spent it. I think I would have travelled overseas a lot more. And around Australia, because I wouldn't have had that tie to a particular place for family reasons. I think I would have travelled a lot more, and I would have been to a lot more places that I haven't been yet and may never get to now.
And do you think you would have had a different profession or any of that sort of thing? Would you have pursued other goals?
I probably wouldn't have been a high school teacher.
Yeah.
I've always said that if I wasn't a high school teacher, and I wasn't a high school teacher for my whole life, I only did it for 10 years out of 40 plus, but if I hadn't been a high school teacher, I said I'd have been a stand-up comic or a landscape and wildlife photographer.
Yeah.
Ironically, I'm now a landscape and wildlife photographer. But
well, it was probably a good choice. You're not very funny.
No, exactly. So, and you know, you being a stand-up comic by yourself out in the beach or in front of a waterfall isn't terribly entertaining.
I didn't realize how hard that job is. Like, you have to get so used to what they call bombing.
Bombing.
Getting on stage and just effectively not getting the reaction from the audience that you wish you got, like, enough laughs, right? Yes. Where they're just like, oh, this isn't funny. So, it is... I respect comics so much, whatever language you speak, because it's just, you're constantly having to put yourself out there.
I think there's also and I've been to, I don't hesitate to say a lot, I've been to several comedy clubs, amateur hour type comedy clubs.
Recently or?
Not recently. The most recent ones I've been to were, there used to be a once a week comedy club in a little dive of a bar in the basement of a hotel down the road from the office building that the company I worked for in Canada was. So, whenever I would go to head office and stay there for a couple of weeks, there'd be at least one Thursday night that I was there that I might go to this comedy club. And they're amateur hours, so most of them were bombs.
Yeah.
Some of them were genuinely funny, but even if you're genuinely funny, it doesn't necessarily mean you get a lot of laughs and applause.
Yeah.
And having watched a lot of... I've been to several really big comedians and watched them live. And watched a lot on video, on television, on YouTube and things. Some of them are not very funny, but they get a laugh because of who they are. My favorite example of that is Dave Chappelle. if you read a transcript of what Dave Chappelle says, you would think he was a political commentator.
Well, I think
he's just not funny. But the fact that he's Dave Chappelle means he's funny.
But it's also his delivery, right?
Oh, it is. Yeah. And part of it is delivery. But the thing is now that I reckon the first 10 years of Dave Chappelle's life, if he hadn't come up with, well, somebody else came up with the idea and he agreed to it, doing the Dave Chappelle TV show.
Yeah.
If they hadn't come up with that skit comedy show, he never would have become famous. If he'd just been a stand-up comic doing clubs and pubs, I don't think he would have been who he is. But because everybody knew him from this TV show, they expect him to be funny.
Mm.
So how many times if you watch videos of well-known comedians, they walk on stage and people start laughing and shouting.
Yeah.
And so there is this expectation that you're going to be entertained and it's going to be funny. They can say anything. Billy Connolly could walk onto the stage and just go, fuck you, and everybody would laugh.
Well, I think you get to that stage, though, right? It's like you get so big that people like whatever you do.
Mm.
And it's the same with musicians, I think, where you can, once you've broken through and you have a big following that just love you.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what you do after that, they're going to follow you because they're diehard fans.
Exactly.
And that's the sort of, it's kind of irritated me a few times with bands because, they go in some weird fucking direction with a new album and you're just like, I love you guys and I can listen to this, but Jesus, the previous album was so much better. Could you have just stayed in, like, just repeat that album? Just tour and just play that one album for the rest of your lives, please. What do you think it is about American comedians being so big? Because I find if I were to sit down and look up and list my favorite comedians, I really love the dark humor that seems to be American humor. I think there's quite a lot out of Britain, but I probably just don't get exposed to it as much. Yeah. I don't find Australian comedians that funny. Some of them are, but they tend to be so much more tepid.
I think the funniest Australian comedians are the ones who've made it in America and live there.
Yeah.
And that's because their humour is... But the art of comedy is... And I can't... There was an Australian comedian, and I apologise to him, and I apologise even more because I can't remember his name, who I heard on radio years and years ago say, the art of humour is telling people the truth that they don't want to hear.
Yeah.
And therefore, the darker you are, the funnier that is.
Yes.
And that's the Dave Chappelle stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and... And there's a lot of comedians who are like that. Jim Jefferies, I think, is the funniest Australian comedian by so much that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But he's funny because 90% of what he's saying is politically incorrect and it's offensive.
And what?
But he's making the point
that
people think it's offensive by saying it.
He does a good skit. I played this. I think I broke it down recently. His guns one, right? Of like,
look, it's genius.
There's one reason for you to own guns in the US, which is perfectly fine. Fuck you, I love guns.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's like, if you just said that, everyone would be like, all right.
Yeah, I've got nothing to argue with.
But when you pretend it's about, it's for protection.
Yeah, man. It's my right to bear arms.
Yeah. He's bullshit.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Yeah. He's very funny, but he's made a living for himself in America. He comes to Australia and people have hardly heard of him. Yeah, they know who he is.
Yes.
But he's just not funny in Australia. And I think that's part of the problem is that Australians, by their very nature, are humorous people because we tend to be self-deprecating, and self-deprecating humor is funny from anybody.
Yeah,
when you just running down yourself.
Well, and the American comedians seem to get this. Like,
they do.
Dave Chappelle's like that. Louis C.K. like just hounds the shit out of himself.
Yeah.
Ricky Gervais from Britain.
Yeah.
Again, he's got one of those ones of like, you know. Everyone reckons they want to be me because I'm fucking loaded and I've got heaps of money.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, you don't. I've got descended balls. I'm overweight. You know, my hairline's receding. Yeah. You just want my cash. You don't want to be me. You don't want to have to deal with this filthy body that
exactly
I'm in, like,
right.
My life. He's like, I'm not married and I have cats. Like,
yeah, exactly.
And so, it is one of these funny things where you're just like, oh, yeah,
yes,
you know, that's
true.
And he takes the piss out of himself.
He takes it. Yeah. So, that self-deprecating humor thing is so Australian. Everybody does it.
Yeah.
And so, having somebody stand up on stage doing it is just not that funny. And so, it's a weird one. I actually think the funniest people on earth are Irish and Scots.
Why is that?
They're just genuinely stupid. And in the nicest possible
way. In what
way? In the nicest
that
way.
That word means a few different things,
it does,
right?
but just stupid as in ridiculous.
Yes.
Yeah, not dumb.
Yeah.
But ridiculous. And they are happy to point out the ridiculous in everything. and they're politically incorrect.
Yeah,
there are a lot of Brits, English people. Yeah, obviously Scotland is part of Britain and Northern Ireland is part of Britain. But there's a lot of English people who are funny as well. But Scots in particular, Billy Connolly, I think, is the funniest comedian I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of the latter part of his life, he didn't tell jokes. He just told stories.
Yeah.
He started off telling jokes. He was a musician. And then he started, talking between songs, and started telling jokes and then stopped playing music.
Yeah.
And just became a joke teller. And then he just told stories.
It is crazy because I was just thinking of the different types. You've got Billy Connolly, where a lot of the time, I think most of his stand up would be silence or people listening to the story. And then the punchlines are kind of spread sparsely through the interesting stories because he just seems to have the most crazy, convoluted, interesting stories about
and he's
his life.
A physical comedian as well.
Yeah.
He physically acts out his stories. And so you can see the humor in it as well.
But
so.
Then you've got people like Anthony, I think it's Anthony Jeselnik. Do you know that guy? Sure I'm getting his name right. Anthony Jeselnik. Yeah, Jeselnik. So he's an American comedian and he just does fucking dark one-liners or a handful of lines.
Who's the guy? There's an American guy who Billy Connolly says is the funniest man in the world.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name. He's been around for a long time and he does the completely straight-faced, ridiculous one-liners.
Yeah.
And again, that sort of humor I think it's funny for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Where he'll do, in 5 minutes, he'll do 20 one-liners. and you just sit there and go, this is just stupid. But if you had to listen to him for an hour, you'd have forgotten him. And
it's interesting because Anthony will do like 45 minutes of just these, a handful of line jokes, one after the other, and they're all killers. And I think the reason that it's just, you just can't stop listening is because they're constantly, what would you say, subversion? You think it's going in one direction and it goes in another.
Yeah.
Like one of his jokes, I think, was, you know, there was a tragic accident the other day. These kids were playing hide and seek and they went into a junkyard and this kid like went into a fridge, an old 1960s fridge, shut it on himself and, you know, died. And he was like, that's not sad. That's fucking amazing because that kid died a winner.
Exactly.
But they're playing hide and seek, right? And they can get found. Yeah. And I... So, yeah, have all these things where he tells these stories.
Yeah, dark, sad.
And there'll be a single line and you're just like, how did you in five words completely flip that story and end up making me piss myself when it was so dark?
It's that telling you the truth that you didn't want to hear.
Yeah. Do you find it sad that so many people today in this sort of woke age are trying to push back against these parts of comedy where... I think one example would be Dave Chappelle recently referring to trans people. Whether or not you like his comedy,
he came out yesterday and gave a response to that.
Told them all to go fuck themselves.
Pretty much. He just said, you're missing the point. Yeah.
Well, the backstory there is that he was making fun of trans people. You know, well, not making fun of them. He was including them in jokes that he was telling in his most recent thing. But then he tells this really touching story of one of his close friends who was trans.
Yeah.
And as a result of getting bullied by people, ended up committing suicide, you know, and he was saying how much of a tragedy that was. And so, the whole point of his stand-up was to sort of, I think he's one of those guys who just shoots at everyone, right?
Yeah.
It's not punching down or up, it's just everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
And it seems like it's weird where you have the social justice warriors, the woke police, all these people wanting to be politically correct and police what's funny and not funny. And they want to prevent, they want to control comedians, whoever they are, but usually the biggest ones, like Dave Chappelle, and say you can make fun of anyone, just not this small group or that small group.
Well,
or this small
Jim Jeffries is another example of that, where a lot of his humor when he first started was highly misogynistic.
Yeah.
It was really anti-women. But
that's like Bill Burr.
Yeah, but he's not misogynistic himself.
Yes.
The joke is that people think this is funny because some people are actually like that.
And that's the annoying part. I'm not getting the intention.
He's
it's like
pointing
you don't
out,
get the joke.
He's pointing out that this is wrong by making fun of it.
Yeah.
And people, he'd have people protesting at his shows and carrying on about it. And he just said, you're missing the point here.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think there is that element of, in humor where, and look, he's stopped using a lot of those misogynist jokes now because he said, I just can't be bothered arguing anymore.
Well, he probably gets old too.
Exactly. Like, and again, he said, they're actually not funny anymore.
Yeah.
Because there, he said, there are so many examples. And he points to the Me Too movement. He said, it stopped being funny when thousands of people kept coming out and saying, this is happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When it was one or two people who were doing horrible things, you could point out how stupid and horrible it was. But when it became a whole lot more obvious that there are a lot of people doing it, he said, this is no longer funny.
I was hearing Russell Peters. He's one of these huge comedians
as well. He's a riot. Yeah, he's Indian-Canadian.
He makes fun of everyone. Again, all different races and puts
and
on the
mostly
voices.
Mostly the Indian ones. He makes fun of his parents more often than anything else. But
I forgot what I was about to say about Russell Peters.
Sorry.
He was coming out and just saying, that these people just don't get it. Right, like the whole.
Yeah, I'm
point
not
is,
racist.
I'm
yeah,
not. Trying,
I hate everybody.
I'm not trying to offend people. My intent when I tell these jokes isn't to target a racial group or a sexual group or a religious group and make fun of them and like, ha ha, these people suck, and I want to offend them. It's more about bringing us all together by pointing out the differences and
that everybody has got something that's laughable.
Yeah, and that it is weird. The moment you make things like that taboo and you sort of say you can do this and you can't do that, you put a wedge between the groups. I think this was one of these things. I think it might have been Ricky Gervais talking about this, where British humor involves so much self-deprecation, but also taking the piss out of everyone.
Yes,
because it brings them together as a cohesive
it
unit.
Does.
And I feel like that's what the woke brigade, the social justice warriors, don't really get with someone like Dave Chappelle making fun of trans people. Or making jokes that include trans people.
Yeah, and that's
it's
the thing.
It's bringing them together and making them part of it.
He doesn't tell jokes. And so he's not doing set-up jokes that are making fun of trans people. He is pointing out the stupidity around some of the other beliefs and things that people have about trans people. And
well, one of his jokes, what was it? It was like, you know, it's just crazy that these people can just decide one day that they're going to be, you know, they've grown up men and they're just like, you know what? I'm fucking woman. Yeah. And he's like, you know what? I'm fucking Chinese.
Yeah.
You know, and he goes down with that joke.
Yeah.
And it's like, again, if you just say, oh, he's being racist or you know, transphobic, you're like, you're missing the point. He's not trying to say you shouldn't be trans or you're a piece of shit for being trans. He's just trying to point out the funny aspect of like, wow, people can change this much.
Yeah.
And it's funny that we think, okay, being trans is fine. But if you were to identify as a different race, no, you can't do that, you know. Or if you were to identify as a different species or something, it's like, no, you can't do that. So
an elephant.
Yeah. What was the original question?
I don't know. What was it?
We went around and around and around there.
What would you be? And I said I'd be a stand-up comedian.
That's where we right. Went. Yeah.
So what would you be?
Probably doing jiu-jitsu. And at the gym still, so
you'd be,
I wouldn't have my dad bod. I'd probably still be fit.
Yeah.
Probably be a lot poorer. Although I might be richer.
You'd be in the octagonal ring.
I don't know if I'd be doing MMA, no.
No.
I never wanted to get punched in the face.
No, funny about that.
I was happy doing jiu-jitsu and, you know, choke me out 100 times and I'm fine as long as you obviously-
It'd revive me.
Well, no, let the blood flow again, you know. Yes. Hold the choke on until I pass out and let go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll wake up and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
But being punched in the face has never been
never been a favorite thing of yours.
Well, I think I heard Bill Burr talking about this. He's another comedian you guys should check out, and he was just like, if you want to be a boxer, you better be a fucking good boxer.
Oh yeah.
You don't want to be
learn
the guy
defense.
That everyone smashes.
Yeah. Learn defense.
Yeah. And I think that was the thing with jiu-jitsu. It's like, yeah, you could break my arm, break my leg, at least all that stuff can get fixed with surgery. And even if I end up with this rickety old body, at least I've got my mind. But if you punch my head into the point, you know, I think it's only like two concussions. And a lot of the fighters that I was training with that were MMA fighters, it was like once you got to, you'd been knocked out twice, three times, they were like, you should consider quitting.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you don't want permanent damage. Like I had friends who'd been knocked out, you know, probably getting close to 10 times and you're just like, you're fucked, dude. Yeah. Like you're literally fucking your brain. You're going to have brain damage as a result. But that's why I've always found it really funny that you don't like MMA. You think it's grotesque and violent, but you like boxing where the target is effectively just the head.
I know. There is no logic.
At least in MMA, they can be choked out.
I can explain why I can't defend it. There's a big difference.
It'd be interesting to know if you were 30 years younger and went to an MMA gym and trained the different.
Oh yeah. Things. And I've done boxing about twice in my life and I was terrible at it. So. It's not like I did the sport and appreciate it from that point of view. It's just I grew up watching that sport. I did not grow up watching MMA. And there's a lot more.
Very few of us did. Even I. Like, yeah. I probably, what, it would have started in the late 90s?
About 30 years ago. There's a lot more technique involved in MMA that is subtle and hidden to your average punter like me. Yeah. I've been watching boxing for more than 50 years. I can pick a good boxer in a minute in the ring.
Yeah.
I can watch an MMA fight and I most of the time genuinely couldn't tell you whether they were good or bad because they're just beating the shit out of each other.
Well, the interesting thing, and this is probably why a lot of people get sucked into MMA, is that there is so many different variables that fighters get to play with.
Yeah,
so with boxing, I mean, and again, I don't know boxing as well as I know MMA, so I'm sure that there are different, you know, people who have different strengths and weaknesses in boxing. Mm. But obviously, when your only targets are effectively, you know, the chest up, and you've got, three punches and a few different stances in footwork, you're kind of limited in comparison to a sport where you can do exactly that.
You can punch, you can kick, you can grapple.
Elbows, knees, you can grapple, you can do wrestling, you can do Thai boxing.
Yeah.
And so, I think a big part of it is that you end up with fights that become really, really interesting because you don't know, you know, this person's really good at their stand-up. They have a really solid right hook. And if they get taken to the ground, though, they're fucked.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there'll be the person
they
pair them
up with.
There are
the others who can't punch for the sake of yourself.
Exactly.
But they're going to take you down and you're never getting up again.
And then there'll be that, okay, well, all right, we're going to pair these two people up. You know, they're complete opposites. But then they each train each other's thing or at least the defenses against yes. one another's strengths. And so they actually end up staying away from mm-hmm. where they would normally go. The worst is when you see guys who are Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts. You quite often see freaks go in there. You're just like, holy shit, Jacare, you know, is this Brazilian black belt. He had his arm broken in a fight with Roger Gracie and just didn't tap and won just with a broken arm. Tucked it into his belt and was just effectively ran out of the square and kept getting called back in until the buzzer went. And Roger was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I've literally broken your arm off. He goes in, but because he's so good, if he takes on other black belts that he knows that are freaks, they all do stand up.
Yeah.
Because they're just like, well, I don't want fuck getting on the ground. Well, we won't get anywhere.
Yeah.
We'll both defend like crazy and nothing will happen. But you end up then with them in stand up and you're like, well, this is fucking boring.
Yeah. Because
they're not good at stand up.
Show me some Thai boxes, thanks.
Yeah. I don't know. So I think that, once I got into jiu-jitsu and you learn the depths of that, it just got me much more interested.
But to me, it's because it's almost anything is allowed. It's just looks like street fighting to me.
Well, that's what it's meant. I guess the point is that you have loosened up the rules enough that you get a better idea of what actual fighting would be like if you took someone on. Whereas like with boxing, it's like, for me at least, in terms of if you were actually trying to replicate a real life fight, who's going to say, all right, we're only going to hit here, here, and here. We must be standing up. Someone separate us if we get clogged. Oh, like
exactly. And that's that thing of, I could take on the world featherweight boxing champion. You know, featherweight weighs half what I weigh. and I would destroy him unless we had to box.
Yeah.
Because all I would do is just charge him, shoulder charge him, get into the ground, and I would crush him. I wouldn't have to do anything else because I weigh 130 kilos.
Well, that's why I'd love to see
twice that. Yeah, you know, I could be three times his age. And that's where one of those things where size matters.
Yes.
And that's why all those physical fighting things are weight graded.
Well, so, except for, the ultra heavyweights.
Yeah, well,
ultra, it's just like, go to town.
But then there's a disadvantage in being that big. Because you're slower and, I've seen guys who weigh 250 kilos fighting in MMA fights.
What was the black guy's name? And there was a really big black guy who was like a sumo wrestler. Yeah. And I think he went into a few boxing matches and you thought, shit.
If he gets hold of you, he's going to kill you.
Well, he fell on a few guys and effectively was holding them down. But the problem was he gassed himself out.
Yeah, and that's
so
the point.
Tired.
All they had to do was last for 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And the thing is with MMA, they're 5 minute rounds.
Yeah.
And so, if you can stand on your feet, if you can stand on your feet and sort of, in a boxing stance and avoid being hit, you can do that for 3 minutes.
Yeah.
But if you get to grappling for 5 minutes, then there's a huge advantage in being big, but you're going to get gassed really quickly. And you stop breathing. If somebody gets you in a headlock and you can't breathe anymore because you can't, you can't get any oxygen, and bang, you're gone.
So. It's one of those things. Kel hates. I often wrestle with her, especially now that she's not, pregnant anymore.
she's very considerate of you.
Well, for 2 years when we got together, we were always sort of play wrestling, and I was teaching her bits of jiu-jitsu, and then she obviously got pregnant with Noah, and then soon after that got pregnant with Joanna, so we just sort of stopped ever doing that again. But it's really funny to see how claustrophobic she gets when you get on top of her and get close to her face, and she's just like, I can't breathe, I can't breathe.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, you get so used to it in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
It becomes one of those weird things where when you wrestle with people all the time and they're just on top of you, crushing your face. You get in places where you literally have your nose, behind someone's balls.
Yeah. And you're doing, you're bridging in really weird positions to try and get them off you and stuff. So,
but it's funny how comfortable you get with those positions. And it's like, I'm breathing. I'm not passing out from being choked. I'm fine. My arm, my body's fine.
Yeah.
But then the complete noob, like Kel, is just like, get off me. I can't breathe.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Next question.
See if I can find another one. Or maybe I've got a good one on the computer here. Best camping spot in Melbourne. This comes from Mark.
In Melbourne?
Yeah, in Melbourne.
In Melbourne or
in Victoria?
Well,
it doesn't have to be in Melbourne. But
if you're in Melbourne, where can you go camping?
Yeah, I would imagine that's more the idea.
I'll give you three.
I think I know which these are going to be.
Wilson's Promontory National Park, which is about 3 hours' drive out of Melbourne.
Yeah, so that's to the southeast.
And you can only camp, or you can get a little cabins and things. It's basically a camping ground.
Is that the lowest part of Australia's mainland? It's mainland
Australia.
Yeah, so you should be able to almost see Tasmania.
Not quite. Not quite. So that one. The second one would be anywhere along the Great Ocean Road.
I thought you were going to say the Otways.
Yeah, so any of the little towns along the Great Ocean Road have camping grounds and things.
I'd say go to the Otways where you're at least getting into the forest as opposed to just someone's
from being
town.
On the beach, you can say go to Lawn.
Yeah.
You can camp on the beach and then you can walk for an hour and you're up in the forest and got these magnificent waterfalls and things.
Yeah.
So, or you can drive for 10 minutes and you're up there. So, and the third one would be to go up north into, say, Wiperfeld National Park or Hattacalkine National Park, which has now got a name change to its original indigenous name, I think, but I'll call it Hattacalkine. So any of those sort of semi-desert national parks up in the northwest of Victoria, which are completely different. Obviously, they're mallee country, so it's low, scrubby eucalypt, sand dunes. It's just different. But it's great country to camp in and go walking around, except in the middle of summer.
What about the Grampians?
Oh, well, yeah, there's, you know, I'd give you 20 others, but you know, I was asked for one, I gave three. So where would you go?
Well, those were mine usually. Yeah. It was either, you know, Wilson's Promontory, probably Gippsland, East Gippsland, and then maybe the Grampians were the ones off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But there are loads of places. I mean, anywhere, if you just drive 2 hours, 3 hours away from the city and go, it's a camping spot.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be a nice place, especially if it's, you know, away from the cities and the large towns.
Yeah. If you come from, Asia or Europe or Africa, most people don't consider going to national parks as a camping thing.
Well, they're probably like Kel would be like, what do you want to get raped?
Yeah.
Well, why would you do that?
Yeah, South America. Yeah. But yeah, Australia has such a, an amazing collection of national parks, all of which are there. And national parks in Australia, for those who aren't aware of what they are areas where, and they're, ironically, they're called national parks, but they're so their status is granted by the federal government, but they're managed by each state that they're in. But they're effectively land that has been set aside for its national or beauty or conservation value.
Yeah.
And so most of them are pristine, or at least as in have never had human habitation in them, or have they might have been farmland 100 years ago and things, but they've been allowed to go back closer to natural bushland and things. So there's some really interesting places to go in national parks. And one of the beauties of coming to Melbourne is that there are so many within a few hours drive, because, you know, the furthest you can drive in Victoria from Melbourne is about 7 or 8 hours away, Victoria being the smallest mainland state. The other thing to do is to go to Tasmania. And the joke is that, go hiking. Tasmania. The joke is about Tasmania is that it's an old people's home in a national park, because it has the highest average age of people, because lots of people retire there.
Yeah.
40% of the state's area is national park.
It's kind of like a really, really big version of Wilson's Promontory, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
You go to the beach in Wilson's Prom and you'll see these large granite boulders that kind of get, these weird reddy yellow colours
on them.
Yeah, yeah, and that's all over the place in Tasmania.
In the northeast.
Okay.
So, no, Tasmania's a wonderful place, but but if you're in Melbourne, obviously you've got to fly there or catch the boat, but... if you're just driving around Victoria, there's, within 2 or 3 hours drive, there's 20 places you could go to that aren't even necessarily in national parks. They're in state parks or even in commercial campgrounds that are in very pretty places with nice walks and things to do.
What do you need if you are someone who obviously has never been camping before or doesn't know much about it and you want to go to these places? What are the sort of bare essentials?
Yeah, well, if you're traveling in Australia, so you're not bringing lots of camping gear with you, so you're not bringing tents and bedding and those sort of things that you typically would own if you were here and going camping a lot, many of these places have cabins or on-site vans and things that you can rent and stay in. So you don't need to bring anything, really.
Yeah.
Alternatively, if you wanted to go out and if you don't mind sleeping on the ground, just on a bedroll or something, then just a small two-man tent. It's enough to pitch your tent.
You can get those from Kmart nowadays.
It costs you 20 or 30 bucks. Yeah. And Yeah, they're not going to last very long, and they're not particularly waterproof.
Buy another one.
But they'll, yeah, exactly. They'll keep the rain off you. They'll keep your body heat in, unless it's, yeah. And look, the other thing is, you know, in Australia is it's never very cold. So, you know, you don't, it's not like you're going out to Canada or Northern Europe or, you know, stuff where it's, go out, you know, camping and it's minus 40 degrees.
Can you go camping up in the mountains when it's snowing?
You can.
Is that a big thing? I don't think I've really heard much about it.
A few people do, but, I don't know why you would, but.
On the 100 square meters of Australian snow.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, Australia's got some of the biggest snow fields in the world. It's just most of them are inaccessible.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. I had a question lined up here.
Uh-oh.
All right, here we go. This will be an interesting one for you, Dad. Do Aussie women fancy foreigners? Give us some tips. You should make an episode about it.
I'm not sure. You better go and ask an Aussie woman.
Does that tend to be a... Do you reckon more Australian women end up with foreigners than, say, British or American women?
I honestly, I got nothing.
All right. Not women, guys. Do Aussie guys fancy foreigners? I reckon I can. I'm sort of. I don't know if I'm allowed to comment on this because.
Well, you married one.
Yeah, I kind of fancy.
So did I. Your mother's a foreigner.
I fancied the shit out of
her. She's born Australian parents, but she was born in England, so that makes her a foreigner.
What's it like to be married to a
to a foreigner?
Yeah. To an English native speaker, Dad.
English native speaker. Yeah,
well, and this is one of these interesting things. For me, I don't know at what point, probably in high school after I started really getting into French, maybe at university when I then started meeting a lot more foreigners and getting to know them, that I sort of was like, you know, I really don't want to marry an Australian girl. I would love to have a family with someone who had grown up in a different culture, spoke a different language, so I could pass on that language to my kids, I could learn that language. It became not necessarily, again, I think I spoke about this, but not like a fetish of, oh, yeah, I love Asian women. Yeah. No, just, well, it wasn't even it needs to be X, Y, Z. It was just, I would love to have that variety. I can't imagine being married to someone who grew up in my town. We'd always known each other. And so-
The high school sweetheart syndrome.
Yeah, where it feels like, I mean, you probably get to a deeper understanding of one another. And you just have that shared history, right? Of just, we went through all the same things.
I think shared history is not necessarily the same thing as a deeper understanding of each other.
Yeah.
I think you can get a deep understanding of people in a few weeks, depending on the relationship that you have with someone.
Especially if you don't speak the same language, that might be hard too. So, yeah.
Well,
Step one, make sure that you both speak a language together.
Yeah, at least learn a language that you can both speak. Yeah, I've got some, you know, people that I've known all my life, and I really don't know them very well.
I think most of us tend to have those people around.
I know, but even
some of those in my family.
But even people that I would have said were close friends, you know, school friends and things that I still speak to and I know, but I don't really know what makes them tick. But I've got other people that I've known for a few years that, and I don't know them any more intimately than I knew my school friends, but we've just, I suppose as older adults, you just talk more about things that are important to you and your philosophies on life and those sort of things. That when you're a teenager, you don't sit down and go, so what do you think of blah, blah, blah? You're really just, you know, bullshitting.
Did you have that moment too when you finished high school and then you end up, you know, going through uni and later on having a family and meeting friends and you're like, fuck, all my high school friends, it was like we didn't really have anything in common besides being the same age and at high school together and sharing that experience.
A few of those. Yeah.
And you're just like, we were kind of just, you know, friends by our situation as opposed to all had inherently the same interests.
Yes, I agree. There are a few. And look, I've got a couple of friends that I've known. One friend that I've known all my life. You know, we grew up as babies together and she lived 5 houses down the road. And I don't see her very often, but we can walk into a room and it's like we've, you know, never been apart. But we were never very close. We just, yeah, we were good friends when we were little kids, but as adults, we weren't very close. But, you know, whereas I've got another school friend who I didn't see for 20 years and now I see her quite regularly and we're like brother and sister. So I think it depends on the person, but most of the people that I went through high school with, I was sort of vaguely friendly with, but you sit there and go, I've now got nothing in common with them. But there's still a bunch of them. You know, there's 120 people finished my year of school in 1975. And I probably still converse on a reasonably regular basis on things on social media with 25 or 30 of them.
I'm trying to think how many it would be for me.
And it's superficial. And a few of them, I just roll my eyes and go, oh, really? But others, I said, you know, there's people that I've, you know, said I've known since I, you know, at primary school. I've known since we were 5 years old for nearly 60 years.
Yeah.
And you're not close, but at the same time, you just, you've got that shared experience, as you were talking about, just going, yeah, well, you know, I won't use a surname. Jane, who owns the B&B in Sorrento, is a good example. This is somebody who I, yeah. You know, since we left school, I've probably spoken to her about 10 times, you know, and that's in 45 years.
Yeah.
But we walk into a room and you give each other a hug and a kiss and you just fall straight back into when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
and so there are some of those and, you know, it's, but there are others of people I went to school with that I was probably closer than I was with people like Jane that, you know, walk into a room and I'd have nothing to say to them. It'd be, oh, hi, how are you? And that'd be the end of it. But yeah, it's just different.
Was it weirder or rarer back when you were growing up for people to be in relationships with quote-unquote foreigners or, say, migrants, people who had just come to the country and didn't speak English as a first language? Was that a thing that was kind of looked down on or seen as like, ooh, that's
so much,
weird?
It wasn't so much looked down on. I grew up in a very sort of white Anglo-Saxon suburb.
Yeah.
There were very few. Like, I mean, we were talking earlier today about, you know, there was, I had one Greek friend, two Italian friends, and one Chinese friend. And they were the only Greek, Italian, and Chinese families in the suburb.
Yeah.
The only ones at my school. You know, 1,000 kids at the school, and there was, you know, like two Italian families, one Greek family, and one Chinese family. Everybody else was Anglo-Saxon Australian. There was, you know, a couple of Germans who arrived, you know, later on in school, and so on. So, my experience as a teenager, in growing up where I did, was so isolated from, you know, a large migrant population. Even though Melbourne had a huge migrant population, still does. I didn't live in an area where that was the case. So I couldn't answer that from first hand. I think though that there was a lot of, certainly among my university friends, because once I got to university, obviously I knew a whole lot of people from a whole lot of wider areas around the state and the city.
Yeah.
There are a lot of those people who would, you know, there was an Italian girl, for instance, that I was, you know, good friends with at university, but there was no chance that I was ever going to be a suitable boyfriend. Her parents just wouldn't have, and she just said, it's never going
to
happen.
Because what? I need to be married to an
Italian.
I need
to be married to an Italian.
That's a weird thing, isn't it, right? Where it would be, those sorts of things were just accepted.
Yeah.
And even when I was dating a Sri Lankan in when I was at university, and I remember her having issues with her parents because she was dating a white person.
Yeah.
And it was always this weird thing of, oh, of course. And then, but to think about, imagine if it were you and mum being like, there's no fucking way that you're dating a black person.
Yeah.
Or an Asian person. Oh, or a Sri Lankan. Yeah. I would be like, you racist pieces of shit.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so it's so weird that it's so weird that that's such a thing in Australia with not everyone, obviously, but that there's still those people who come from foreign countries that have moved to Australia and they're still intent on their kids not being involved with certain races. Yeah. Certain.
I think there's less of that now than there was when I was a kid.
But not only that, the fact that we don't really call that out. You would call it out if it were white people doing it, but I don't think I've ever really heard people saying, you know, these Sri Lankan families that did this when they're like, we just want our kids to marry other Sinhalese. Sri Lankan, they can't even marry Tamil Sri Lankans.
Exactly.
They have to marry Sinhalese Sri Lankans.
I'd rather you marry an Australian than marry a Tamil.
But they would have those sorts of attitudes and we'd be like, oh, okay, well, yeah, of course, because it's their culture, it's their heritage. If you were to be Australian and do that, you would be a
And it's funny because I think it probably was more for girls from those families that were not going to marry white boys.
Yeah.
I had some, a friend of my father's he worked with who was Sri Lankan, Sinhalese, and they had four sons, one of whom was my age.
Yeah.
Two were older and one was younger, but they're all very close. So I knew the four boys. One of them ended up marrying a Sri Lankan girl. The other three married Australian white girls.
Yeah.
I don't think if they had had a little sister that she would have been allowed to marry a white boy. I think it would have been, oh, no, it's you've got weird. To marry a Sri Lankan boy.
It's weird, isn't it? And that's such a foreign thing from me, at least day and age I've grown up. There's no real... I don't think I've ever met any Anglo-Saxon Australians that would have said, you know, my kids will not marry a person of this race.
No, I don't think that.
Unless they were Nazis, like literal.
I'm sure there are some truly racist people Nazis, around, but that'd be a very small part of the population. My grandfather, who lived with us for the last 14 years of his life, he was racist in his behaviour, but not in his attitudes. And I think his behaviour was more of just, you know, a sign of his times. Yeah. Now, this is a person who was born in 1897 and he went, you know, he served in the First World War and he obviously lived through the Second World War and he saw a lot of refugees coming to Australia and he'd bag the refos and, he'd bag everybody that wasn't Australian because they were not Australian. The joke among my sisters and I and our family was, you know, who's going to be the first one to come home with an Asian or a black boyfriend or girlfriend? And I used to joke it would be even funnier if I brought home a black boyfriend. Not is he black, but he's gay. I'm not gay, but my boyfriend is. I grew up with that in the household. My father, and my mother wasn't particularly, you know, racist at all. My father was the least racist person I've ever met. Yeah, he genuinely didn't even notice that people were different. Whereas my grandfather, my mother's father, was just, was that generation older. And if you weren't a true blue Anglo-Saxon Australian, there was something wrong with you. And he wasn't, he would treat Italians, Germans, Russians, French people, Spanish people, exactly the same as he would Africans or Asians. They're all horrible.
Equal opportunities
racist, you know.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't actually matter about your race.
You just weren't Australian. And in fact, Englishmen he called pommy bastards and Irishmen were just mad Irishmen. So, it was if you weren't Australian, you weren't fair dinkum. You weren't, are a human being. So, so the equal opportunity racist. So I grew up in that. Yeah, I'm not like that at all, but I grew up experiencing that attitude, and it was not different from many of his peers, age group.
That must have been so difficult, living through a period where you were at war with countries that were of a different race, and so especially if you served in those wars, because you would be intentionally trained to be effectively racist so that you could deal with doing killing people.
I know. And my grandfather was sort of weird with that regard because he hated Japanese people.
Yeah. Because of the war.
Because of the Second World War. He didn't serve in the Second World War. But he served in the First World War when the Japanese were on our side. And so you'd have thought inherently that, Japanese people are okay. But I think the fact that Australia fought in the Second World War was enough to influence him to decide that all Japanese people were terrible. But that then, he was the equal opportunist, racist. If you just looked Asian, you were horrible. You could have been Chinese, Indonesian, Thai, or anything else, but he just assumed you were Japanese.
It's a human nature thing, right?
Yeah.
We have to be careful because we are pre-programmed to hate outsiders.
Yeah.
Because in the past, you would imagine they would have been dangerous.
Yeah, to compete with them.
But they we would have been competing with them for resources, but not only that, they would have been carrying potentially diseases that we were naive to, right? If you were in hunter-gatherer groups and you lived in one area and you had another group that lived in another, it's probably dangerous for you to come in contact because either you're going to be at war taking each other's resources or you're potentially going to be spreading diseases to one another.
Or they're going to be stealing, as my grandfather used to say, who are these bloody foreigners coming
stealing
here?
Our women.
Stealing our women and our white bread.
Oh, but the guys can go. The guys are fine.
I don't want them. The women are the real resources. Was the question again?
But it was this one about,
Aussie women fancying foreigners or Aussie men.
Would you imagine that there is, if you were to get the stats of Australian men, they're probably talking about Western Anglo-Saxon white men, but Australian-raised men and Australian-raised women, do you think that there would be a difference in the proportion of how many people in each group would be married to foreigners or involved with foreigners? Do you think there's a gendered thing there? Do you think men are more likely to end up with foreign, say, women, or even gay men with other gay men, obviously, than women are? It'd be interesting to know more
about
that.
I could hype, based on my experience, I would think it would be the reverse.
More women with more foreign men?
The other way around.
Australian men with foreign women.
No, sorry, the other way around from that. There would be more Australian women marrying foreign men than Australian women marrying foreign men. But it's that sort of weird one where I think there was an experience of that Sri Lankan family. I think there would have been a reluctance to have your daughters marrying out of your nationality or your race, whatever race means.
Yeah.
As opposed to your sons, for whatever reason. That was the experience and my impression. I have no real data around it. My impression growing up that was the case. But I don't know that that's the case anymore. I think it would probably even itself out. I think there is, just getting back to the original question, I think there is an attraction to the exotic.
Yeah.
And I know even, as the grumpy old man in his 50s working in North America, there were plenty of young Canadian and young Americans that I used to work with who would be more than happy for me to come out to the pub or club with them because they just said, the women will flock to your Australian accent.
And you're just
going to pick up the dregs?
What are you going to have?
What are you going to have? Exactly.
Tell my wife.
Exactly. So,
it is interesting how that works, right?
So, I think it's that attraction to the exotic.
I wonder if that still works, though, for Americans, because they're in so much media, TV shows, movies, podcasts, audiobooks, everyone is so used to them that it's not exotic.
American accent. It's not exotic.
Whereas the average American would be like, if they heard me speaking, they'd be like, where are you from?
Yeah.
Are you from some other part of the US?
I know. Yeah.
Well, you'd be like, guess again.
Guess again. Well, the number of times that I heard, are you English or South African?
And you're like,
the answer is no. They look at you like, what?
Yeah. I know. Put Australia on the map. Yeah. Where is it? Show us.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Well, my gag used to be because I did a lot of conference presentations and so on there. And my gag used to be, when you introduce yourself and say where you come from. When I was in America, it'd be always, my name's Ian and I'm from the really deep south.
Mm-hmm.
Southern
Hemisphere.
Yeah.
Get the
accent. Yeah.
I think it would be interesting to know more. It's so funny that these kind of questions are almost forbidden to be ever studied. So, I doubt there are probably studies out there, right?
There'll be somebody who's done it.
It'd be interesting to know what the stats are on Asian women with Caucasian men in Australia versus Asian men with Caucasian women.
There's no question in Australia which way that is skewed.
It's weird. It seems like it's politically incorrect to ever talk about, but that seems to be something I notice all the time, especially in Melbourne, that you will go out and you will see Caucasian Aussie guys with Asian women.
Young, attractive Asian women.
Yeah.
And these old, fat, bald Australian guy. No, I know. I'm exploiting the cliche for its humorous value, but there is an element of that, of the so-called mail order bride.
Yeah.
And Australia, not so much, but in America, it's not Asian women, it's Russian.
What?
Yeah, Russian wives.
Oh, yeah.
The mail order
or
Russian
the Ukrainians.
Bride and Ukrainians. That, it's not so much in Australia. Australia, it's a lot of Filipino women.
We had, I guess this is sort of a bit of gossip for you guys. We had a neighbor that did that to his family, right?
Yeah, he's Thai.
Thai, was it? Yeah. So, he went to Thailand. And again, you fill me in on where I go wrong. But so, I was friends with, me and my sister were friends with the daughter of this family. And the interesting story is, I think, what was the story? He and his wife had both had children to other people in other families, then got
together.
They'd
both been married
separately.
And
cheated on their respective partners.
They got together
and
had another child
who was our friend that we grew up with.
Yeah.
And later on, he ended up-
He ended up working in Thailand.
And was doing business trips over there.
Hooked up with a woman over there.
And then, or a girl, right? She was like 19 or something.
Younger than
crazy.
He was, considerably.
He would have been 50. He came back and it was effectively like, so I'm engaged to this young girl. I'm divorcing you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to bring her over to Australia.
And then she ended up leaving him. He went back and got another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, it is this weird thing that obviously there are men on our side of it in Australia who are willing to do that because they can probably attain women out of their league, usually in terms of physicality. Yes,
you get a young, attractive woman.
Yeah. There's no chance a 19-year-old, you know, quote-unquote Australian woman would have ended up with him and be like, yeah, sure. You know, yeah. You're not rich. You're just this weird fat dude.
An ordinary old fat businessman.
Yeah, and yet he...
But he had money in comparison with what these women were used to.
The story was that effectively that he got these women over to Australia. They got a visa. They ended up getting married. They became Australian.
And then said, see ya.
And then was just, after 4 years, was like, I've done my fucking time. I'm out of here.
Exactly.
Yeah. But it's weird because I guess you have men on our side that are willing to do that, that are attracted to that. And there's women on the opposite side that are like, well, this is an easy way out.
Yeah. It's the male order bride thing of, you know, why would you marry a fat old Australian? Get me out of the country I'm in. Not there's anything wrong with the country, but their circumstance.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with the Philippines. I love the Philippines. The people are wonderful. But there are a lot more people in the Philippines who are in very low socioeconomic circumstances
imagine the opportunity of a young... That are just like, where are these fat old Western women? Come over and rescue me or take me home. Exactly. Adopt me.
Exactly. Not going to happen. So...
Yeah, so it is one of these things where obviously it's just like, this is so weird. You know, I feel like you've taken advantage of this woman. And then you're like, well, she's sort of taking you for a ride as well. Yeah. She ends up with Australian citizenship and just bails on your ass. Yeah. But then he just goes back and, got married again, right? And you're just like, this is nuts.
Mm.
But it is one of these really interesting things. I'm always like, I remember going to Costco with my Brazilian friends and just being like, there's a guy, there's an old fat guy with a young Asian woman. They're holding hands.
Yeah.
And then being like, there's another one. And then I asked one of my friends who was, where would she have been from? She was from, I think, either Korea or Japan. And she was like, those women have got those guys wrapped around their fingers and are taking them shopping and being like, you buy me this, you buy me this, you get me this shit. But I was just like, it is so funny. You don't see that in the inverted way.
Of course you don't.
The same way. No. So.
But, that's been happening for years. The whole myth of the sugar daddy nationality wasn't an issue. But young women who were perfectly happy to put up with, rich old men who they know they're going to live a lifestyle that is going to be way out of what is possible. Well, and they just got to put up with this grumpy old bloke for a few years until he drops off the peg.
Well, you forget that we are differently abled, right, as men and women growing up. When, as a boy, as a young boy, as a teenage boy, you are about as poor as you will ever be. Not just in terms of money, but in terms of
value to society.
Value to the opposite sex.
Yeah.
The average woman, say, in her 20s, at her peak, is going to look at you and be like, I have zero interest in what you have to
offer.
You can be the most attractive man in the world, and it's like you don't have wealth, you don't have power, you don't have anything behind you besides that. Whereas on the opposite side, women are probably they're never going to be as powerful in terms of what they can get from their appearance than when they're in their late teens, early 20s, right? And they haven't had to work for it.
Of them have.
Yes, but I mean-
You can work on it.
As in, for those of you who can be born with that kind of appearance, you're effectively born as women millionaires, in terms of what you can use that attractiveness to get you. Like, I mean, who wants to? I don't see marrying a fat billionaire as a very appealing thing, but you could end up marrying a fat billionaire and you've just been, boom, your life's done. You're set. Whereas there is just probably zero men out there, no matter how attractive they are, that will ever find themselves in the same circumstances of, here are all these fat old women that are billionaires that are just like, now, come at me, toy boys.
There's the odd toy boy gigolo who may be paid for their-
Their services,
they're accompanying them, but
probably old paid less than women. Oh, would be paid.
But old wealthy women are not going to marry them.
No,
they're not going to hand them over half their fortune. They're $1,000 a night, but don't bother. Don't bother staying for breakfast.
This is one of those interesting things that no one tends to talk about, that imbalance at that age. And I remember it being so annoying, being a young boy, being like, I can't find a girlfriend my age.
There's no chance because they're all going out with
older guys men. Who have jobs, who are of more educated, are. Who, have more money.
Far more sophisticated.
It was nuts. It wasn't until I think I probably got to, my late 20s and was like, oh shit, now I can get 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, well, now I can date people in their early 20s and I'm crushing it compared to other 20-year-old guys because all of a sudden I have all this experience, education, wealth behind me comparatively.
And you're entertaining. It's like, what does your average 19-year-old male have other
in terms
than,
of experience?
Yeah, testosterone.
Well, and the maturity difference too, right? The women tend to be way more mature in their teen years than men.
Because they hang around with older men.
Yeah, so I just remember finding that really infuriating at the time.
Mm.
Because again, you know, if you're 18, you're not going to be picking up 12-year-olds, you know. But if you're 28, you can pick up 22-year-olds and there's no problem, right? Yeah. So, yeah, it was always an interesting thing. Yes,
well, it used to be the old, you know, extremely sexist gag in the cricket clubs and the footy clubs and things that I used to hang around with. The guys would be, you know, you'd be out there playing cricket and there'd be these, you know, young girls, you know, playing in the playground or whatever, and they'd look at them and go, oh, I'll give them 4 or 5 more seasons.
Jesus.
And then they'll be 20.
Oh, man. It's horrifying sometimes seeing the young kids out there wearing certain clothing. And then you get closer and you're like, Jesus, you're like 10. What are you doing?
I know.
What are you doing?
It's horrible.
How is that with having to raise a daughter? Like, what am I in for? In terms of having to deal with that, when they finally are like, I need to worry about my looks and sexiness and everything. And you're like, dude, hold up.
Yeah, I think your sister was a little more sensible than that.
Yes.
And funnily enough, she went to an all-girls school.
Yeah.
So, there wasn't this daily grind of how do I change my looks to impress boys because she went to an all-girls school. So.
Yeah.
And that's not why we, you know, she chose to go to that school. We didn't send her there to hide her away from boys, but, which doesn't work. But
they get in there.
They do. They find a way. So, yeah, I didn't have to worry about it too much.
Yeah. I guess I'll cross that bridge when I get to it.
Yeah. But- Just get a rocking chair and a shotgun.
Just sit on the front
porch. Sit on the front porch.
Yeah. Keep walking.
Exactly.
Keep walking. All right, we've been ranting for quite a bit.
We have.
Talked about too much.
Too much.
Hopefully, I don't get too many strikes on YouTube for offensive comment. It won't be on YouTube. It'll be on the podcast. But yeah, hopefully you've enjoyed this
website,
episode.
So.
Exactly. Thanks, Dad. Thanks for your 2 cents.
Yeah, my 2 cents, your 2 cents. 4 cents worth.
I know. Yeah, if you guys have made it, we've done 2 hours. So.
I know. It's ridiculous.
There you go. We'll have to do it again.
Next
I'll
time.
I'll let you go. See you, Dad.
Bye.